are listening to The Activity Pod with Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, where we help you stay focused so you can get stuff done. In today's show, episode 13, we interview Samantha Ford. Samantha is an expert in crisis, emergency and business continuity management. And yes, she is a really great friend to have when things go wrong. You can find this episode at theactivitypod.com/13. That's number 13. We talk today about how to mitigate both business and personal crises by having a good plan in place for when things go wrong. We also talk about how to prepare yourself and your family in case of a natural disaster. If you enjoy listening to our show, please sign up to our mailing list at theactivitypod.com/subscribe so you receive valuable tips from our guests and the link to our show notes. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to The Activity Pod, where your hosts, Annette Jones and Mel Kettle, talk accountability and focus on helping you get stuff done so you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want to from life. And now, here are your hosts, Annette and Mel.
Today we are talking about staying focused in a crisis with our guest, Samantha Ford. Samantha has over 15 years local and international experience in crisis, emergency and business continuity management, working with government, banking, human services, health and industrial sectors. She works with organisations to make them more resilient and better able to operate during emergencies, crises and disasters. She also designs and facilitates complex functional exercises for government and corporate clients. In other words, she gets to play lots of war games. Samantha has led international aid and emergency management response and recovery initiatives, as well as having her own successful consulting practice, Adana Consulting, for 5 years. Today, Samantha works at Tigertail Australia, a boutique consulting firm that specialises in risk, crisis, emergency and security management. Welcome, Samantha.
Thanks, Mel. Thanks, Annette. Nice to be
here.
Great
to have you here.
So the first thing we want to know is, do you have a daily routine?
Yes, I do. It does vary depending upon what's going on, but my daily routine consists of trying to get up about half an hour before my son does. As soon as I wake up, before I'm out of bed, I've checked my emails and my calendar to see what's coming at me.
I think every guest has said that.
Yeah. It's kind of my give me five more minutes in bed thing, but realistically I'm already working. But, yeah, ideally for me it's about getting ahead on the domestic chores and the drop-off of my son to daycare and then getting into the office. So, but I'm very lucky in that I get to work quite flexibly, and if I don't have a client to see and I don't get in till 10 o'clock, it's kind of, okay, but for me it becomes, well, I've always got something else to do, or whether it's client work or business development or something else, and I've got to try and get as much done on the home front before I leave so that I'm not racing at 1,000 miles an hour when I get home.
Yeah.
And that I actually get to spend some time with my family.
When you say you have flexibility, do you mean flexibility of where you work or the hours that you work?
All of the above. Mm-hmm. Depending upon if I've got client work, obviously, then and it's actually face-to-face, if it's face-to-face client work, then I've got to be where they are.
Sure.
If it's work that sort of involves writing a plan or reviewing something or writing a report on the back of an exercise or planning an exercise, I can pretty much do that from anywhere with an internet connection. Mm-hmm. I find that if I'm creating an exercise, I'll do it in the office because I like to be quite collaborative about that kind of activity. If I'm writing a plan or reviewing a plan, then I'll often do it from home where it's just sort of my own space, it's my own quiet time. And because of the amount of time in those kinds of activities, I can do the drop-off really quickly to daycare and then be back and working almost immediately. So
yeah,
it's about where I need to maximise my time tends to be when I decide where I work. So, yeah, but I can work any day, any time, whatever suits me, and I find that I tend to work when my head's in the right space. So, for example, last week we had a trade show that we did, and I had a tender that had to be submitted by two tenders that had to be submitted by Friday, and one was a really big one, and I was like, oh, God, there's no way I can possibly finish this off given I'm sort of doing this trade show, blah, blah, blah. And I was sort of saying to my colleague, I said, oh, I might go home tonight and write it. He said, do you feel like doing that? And I said, God, no. It's the last thing I feel like doing. He said, don't, come in tomorrow morning here, find a quiet spot and do it then. And it's so true, because if your head's not in the right space, it takes you twice as long to do what you need to do anyway. So
yeah, that's for sure.
Great advice.
Yeah. You mentioned complex functional exercises.
Yes, I picked up on that.
What are they? They're not, like, they're not push-ups, mean? I don't think. Squats and all
no,
that.
No, I don't know, sometimes.
Sometimes it's a complex functional exercise for me to get out of bed in the morning.
Basically, when you've got a lot of stakeholders involved. So we work with private sector and we work with government. Sometimes we create an activity which simulates a particular type of crisis or disaster. Mm-hmm. And when I say complex, it's generally I'm referring to an activity which requires physical movement. Yeah. So it's not just being done around a boardroom table or in a theatre. It's actually being done on the ground, on an actual site or a simulated location, which has got, you know, concrete blocks down and train crashes and all sorts of things going on.
Yeah.
When we're working with multiple stakeholders of different backgrounds. So we work a lot with the emergency services and government, and often when we do exercises for them, there's more than one agency in the room. So we can have police, fire, ambulance, emergency services, we can have Premier and Cabinet, we can have any other, public service organisation that might have a role, so energy and utilities or public works and things like that, all involved in the one piece of work. Or similarly for a private sector organisation, such as a Big Four bank, the stakeholders involved are the people that are actually sort of running the exercise internally, the senior executives, we're talking sort of CEOs of Big Four banks and their executive team, mm-hmm. government that actually sort of play in that space that might need to advise them, so government relations activities that go on, Reserve Bank representatives, things like that. So it's about sort of when it's about simulating an event that creates an environment which heightens stress and requires a well-thought-out management response.
Yeah. So without breaching any client confidentiality, what sort of things might you be practicing? Like what sort of crises and emergencies might you be trying to prepare for?
Okay, so ones that we've done sort of in the last 12 months that sort of spring to mind, national oil spill activities. In the private sector, we did what was referred to as a sensitive issue, which was where we created a scenario that implied imminent arrest of two staff members in a country where the laws are significantly different to Australia, that held big reputational risks with any of that information getting out or any of that activity becoming known.
Mm-hmm.
So about managing reputation, managing the sensitive nature of the issue, also managing the people side of the issue. So we've got two people potentially arrested. How do you look after them? How do you look after their family, particularly when there's no real information around whether or not there's any implied guilt.
Right.
So that was a really interesting one we've done very recently. National oil spill exercise. We also did at the beginning of the year, I think it was end of last year now, one of the ones that I did, which I think was the most fun, was we worked out at the urban search and rescue site in New South Wales, and they've got this big simulated site with concrete blocks and car parks and collapsed buildings and quite literally a smashed train in a tunnel. And we had the engineering services actually sort of running through there and making assessments of the site, identifying where the additional risks were to the emergency services workers before they could actually go in and things like that. And that's kind of the really fun stuff, because you get to climb over things as part of your preparation. You get to wear a hard hat and a vest and climb through things and steel cap boots and stuff. And, you know, we do things where we sort of create, injured people. So we moulage, we put makeup on them and, you know, dress them up, put blood all over, fake blood all over them and things like that. That's always fun.
Sounds like a scene from The Walking Dead.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, we're doing one with another government client that's actually around active shooters later this month, which is really interesting. It's an iconic venue in New South Wales that we're working with, and we're working through their security activities and sort of simulating an event which promotes danger to their people and the public. And again, you know, you've got to be really sensitive in the way we do that, but we've also got to provide them with the realism that gets them thinking in the right way. And it's, you've got to sort of play to who's in the room, and you've got to gauge the audience consistently with things like that because of reactions that people can have.
Yeah.
I remember reading years ago, I read Rudolph Giuliani's book, Leadership. And he talked a lot about...
Oh, I've read that book. It's awesome.
It's one of my favourite books ever, and I just saw it on the bookcase last night and thought I must read that again. But he talked about the response to 9/11, and he said the biggest challenge that we had was that the city's crisis centre was in one of the World Trade buildings. Oh, and so we had to relocate without having anything prepared because of where it was and because of the imminent danger in that space. And he said, we just learned so much from that. But the biggest learning was that you make sure that you have your crisis centre in a spot that there is absolutely no way it could become a part of the crisis. Mm. And I just thought that's so true because, you know, and as a small business owner, I'm very woefully underprepared for any emergency. But whenever I go away, I back up if I didn't take my laptop with me, then I'd back everything up in two places, and I'd keep one in my house and I'd give one to somebody else to have it in another location so that if my house burned
down. And now you can back up to the cloud, so it's even better.
Yeah, I know, but that wasn't, you know, that didn't exist at the time. And I must say I'm not very good at backing up to the cloud either.
It will be now.
So,
What that also speaks to about the dual locations or the alternate locations that's not in a vulnerable position is it also speaks to priority being safety of your people. Like you see mine site accidents and things like that, and people get all enraged. You know, why don't they send people down? Whatever else, you know, they know that there are people down there. They know that they're still alive. Why don't they send people in? And it's that. Well, we could send people in, and then we're risking 10 more people or 20 more people dying on top of those that are already there. Yeah. And it's that really hard call that people have to make around, you know, whether or not they send. Whether or not they're adding to the risk by sending the people in to actually try and rescue. You've got to do that whole weighing up of the risk-benefit of 10 people dead versus one person dead. And it's a really horrible way to look at it, but these are considerations that have to be made.
And if you have a good plan in place, then everybody knows what that is. And so if you are a miner and you are stuck in a mining emergency down a shaft and you know that, well, this is the emergency plan because we've rehearsed it, and I know that they're not going to send anyone down until they've done, you know, this test and that test and other tests. So, you know, let's just sit here and be patient.
Yeah, and it's so hard because it becomes an emotional thing. A colleague of mine once, he was working, I'm going off track a bit here, but she was working on an operation years ago, and essentially what happened was there was a helicopter that actually went into some power lines that the actual team were doing reconnaissance of the actual issue that they were responding to as an emergency management team. And the organisation that she was actually assisting, two or three of their staff were lost in this helicopter crash at the same time that they were actually running this emergency organisation. And she was actually from an outside agency at the time, Emergency Services. And you've got all these people in the room and, oh, shit, you know, all these people have just died that we work with, that we're personal friends with and all the rest of it. And she actually sort of took it on herself. She just actually, and it's been remarked about many, many times over the years, that she actually turned around and she said, right, you guys are no good to me right now. You need to go in the room, debrief about this, talk about this. I'll look after the operation for the time being, come out in about an hour after you've talked things out, and then we actually have to get on with this. And you've got to have that person that sort of got that level head that can actually sort of take themselves out of that moment and sort of focus. That's a really good sign of leadership.
So just back to my small business and my lack of preparedness for anything going wrong, particularly from a technological perspective. What are some tips for some small business owners? What sort of things should we be thinking about, you know, worst case scenario that could happen to us or our business? And what are some of the things that we can do so that people around us, you know, for example, know what to do should we die, or what to do should there be a business emergency?
Yeah, look, it's one of those things, like you say, it's so easy for small businesses to sort of go, oh, it's not going to happen to me, or what's the worst thing, it's only me anyway. But the thing is, it's not only you, particularly if you've got a family. Your family relies on your income, relies on your business as well. You've got friends, you've got colleagues that rely on you, you've got clients and customers that rely on you. Essentially, the best thing I think for businesses to do is actually recognise that there are risks that apply to them, that, you know, a lot of small businesses aren't around for a long time because they don't actually make it through, whether that be through crisis or just financial difficulty is neither here nor there. It's about making yourself and your organisation more resilient to any kind of disruption or any kind of emergency that comes your way, whether it's personal or natural or what have you. And one of the ways that I used to do that, and we even do it for our own business at Tigertail, is, you know, actually identify what your risks are. You know, what, and the simplest way to do that, what could go wrong? What would really hurt my business? How would I respond if something did happen? Just those really basic low-level questions, and start there and write it down. And then go, okay, well, what have I got in place? So you've got a backup system for your computer, you've got a second laptop, you've got, you know, you're back up to the cloud or something else except for Mel. But you know what you've also got? You've got a network.
Yeah.
So I did that with a friend of mine once who was affected by Brisbane floods a few years back. I just gave her a call. I knew that she was affected by the floods and I said, look, not sure if there's anything I can do, but you want to divert your calls to me if you want to, you know, if you want me to do anything, you want me to do any administrative tasks, you want me to contact any of your clients, happy to do that. And you know what? Most of your business network, particularly in small business, will do that. And, you know, I need somewhere to work from for a week. Can I hang out at your place? That kind of stuff is really easy to do. And just to have those conversations with your colleagues and say, well, you know, these are the things that I think, you know, could possibly happen to me. These are the things that I can see might happen to your business. How about we help each other out should that happen? And same way you sort of become an emergent volunteer when you sort of when something does sort of go on, like, you know, you bake cookies and meals and stuff for people. It's that whole, don't forget about your own immediate community as well as the wider community. And your own network. So yeah, and look, so for me, it's identifying what your risks are, identifying what you would do if one of those things actually happened, and making sure that someone else knows about your arrangements.
I've got a friend who a couple of years ago said to me, she went overseas for a business trip for a month, and she said, yeah, before I went, I sat down with my husband and I showed him my death book. And he was completely freaked out. It had in it who all her clients were, what the current work was, her invoicing system and who was up to date and who wasn't with payments, what all of her passwords were for her social media accounts, for her bank accounts, and everything that was involved in running her business, just in case something happened and he needed to shut it down or sell it. And I just remember thinking, what a fantastic idea. Because
it is
when,
a great idea.
Oh, yeah. Because when my father died, as you would remember, he was running his business still. And the saving grace was that, and this is a bit morbid, sorry, everybody, but the saving grace for my brother and I was that he was alive for, you know, he was injured and he was alive. He was conscious and capable of talking to us for a couple of days before he died. And in that time, he just gave my brother the biggest, quickest overview of everything with his business, what all the bank details were, where his client list was, what his invoicing system was, so that we could take it over and resolve everything. But the other thing there was his community of colleagues and business friends just were amazing how they supported us. They just, one guy in particular rang us and said, oh, you know that I'm semi-retired, but anything I can do for your dad, if you want me to take over all of his clients and just get it to a point where you can sell it or pass it on to another firm, let me know, particularly those that had current matters that needed to be worked on in the next couple of weeks. And it was really quite affirming to us to see that.
Yeah, it is. And it's really and I guess that's what I mean by don't discount your network, because, you know, you build up a network of colleagues and clients that actually, you know, they care about you because you care about them, particularly as a small business. And you will be so – I mean, you obviously were then, but, you know, you can be so surprised by what people will actually do to help you out when you need it. And you see it so often, you know, the good in people coming out and you know, lending you a hand in the most – whether it's on a personal level or at a business level, when you do experience hardship. But it's also about understanding where those connections are, who can actually be of assistance to you and who you can be of assistance to yourself. And actually having those conversations with people, you know, start talking about it. The unfortunate thing that I find is with smaller business in particular is they just don't want to talk about it. It's that constant, I guess, particularly in the first few years, that constant struggle of actually achieving your success and then sustaining it. And so you've got so much going on that you don't want to even think about it not working. But, you know, if you're a small business and you experience a big disaster of any kind or any kind of personal hardship, then chances of your business surviving are really, really small. So you've got to set yourself up the best way you can to ensure your resilience as a business owner, but also, you know, as a human. So
can I just reinforce that, because as a survivor, for want of a better word, of the Brisbane floods with my two businesses, one was totally wiped out and the other one was without power and so forth for over a week or whatever, and had about a foot of water right the way through it. As a small business owner, I was completely taken by surprise and had no plan in place whatsoever. So I think it's really, really important. I mean, it's something that you just would never dream about happening. And I'd really like to encourage every small business owner. You know, you think it might not happen or it won't happen to me. There's no way in the world. I mean, if you could see the store that was completely wiped out, everybody could not believe that it got wiped out because of how high it is. But
and do you know what? There's such good tools out there for small business owners that are free. Do you know two of the best sites for actually how to prepare your business for any kind of flood or fire? New South Wales SES, so ses.newsouthwales.gov.au have storm safe, flood safe, business safe. Mm-hmm. They're all toolkits, tsunami safe probably. they've got cyclone links and things like that as well. New South Wales RFS have the same thing for bushfires. Mm-hmm. And I think also, I'm just having a quick look while I'm talking to you, but in Queensland, because you guys are in Queensland, QFES, so Queensland Fire and Emergency Services, on their website have a community safety section. And on there it actually has some tools for community education and, you know, how to plan for escape routes from your home, you know, tips and tricks around, you know, things that might cause fire and all that kind of stuff, you know. But it's really worth going to those sites where they've got free information for small businesses and for individuals to actually sort of learn about how you can prepare yourself. You know, one of the things that as I was in Brisbane during the Brisbane floods, and I said to my husband, or my now husband, Ben, I said to him, oh, I'm just going to go down to the shops. He said, why? And I said, because it's going to peak, the river's going to peak and it's going to flood. And within a day there's going to be no groceries left in the grocery store, and we shop on an as-needs basis because we lived across, you know, just up the road from Coles.
So
I just went stockpiled and got what I needed to get. But I did it not at the last minute. I did it, you know, a week before. I also, because I did a lot of pandemic planning and business continuity planning in the years prior, always had a certain number of, you know, non-perishable items in the house, and, you know, always had, you know, a gas bottle, always had a gas stove, always had matches, always had candles, all that kind of stuff. And it's about those little bits of preparation that we just don't do anymore, that our parents used to do all the time. To be prepared. And you can do the same thing for your business, you know. Just make sure your battery's charged up on your on your laptop and your phone. You know, get yourself a little mobile charger that you can do it from your car for your phone and things like that. And that way you can stay in touch when you need to stay in touch with people. You can still manage your emails via phone and all sorts of things, as long as you've got some source of power to keep them charged.
Yes.
And they're just really little things that are both useful for personal and for business, small businesses. But from a big business perspective, got to have a plan. You've got to really properly identify your risks, assess your risks and analyse them, and you've got to have a plan in place of what to do. Friend of mine who's actually a CEO of somewhere turned around to me the other day and said, oh, you don't need plans, you don't need to exercise, you just need to do shit when it happens. And I said, all right, what if you're not around?
I know what that's like. It doesn't work.
what if you're not around as the CEO? Yeah, you know how to do this stuff, but your team doesn't.
What if you as the CEO is arrested on, you know, kiddie porn charges and the whole world goes to pot for your company? What do your staff do then?
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, well, it's not funny.
No.
But it could happen.
It could.
Yeah.
It could.
That's right. It can happen. Stuff happens. That's the thing. I mean, stuff happens.
Yeah.
All the time. And it's often you can plan for everything, and it's often the one that you don't think of that bites you in the ass. But because you've done all that other planning and that other consideration, and you've had those thoughts around what could go wrong, how you'd respond to it, then you're better prepared when something does happen.
That's right.
We would like to give a huge thank you to Kylie Meller from Duo Sister. Kylie is a freelance graphic and web designer and the first sponsor of the Activity Pod, and she is responsible for our fabulous logo and artwork. Thank you, Kylie. If you are looking for a graphic or web designer, then look no further than Duo Sister. You can find Kylie on Twitter at Duo Sister, DuoSista, or www.duosister.com.au. Thanks again, Kylie.
I just want to move away from the business side of things now and touch on some personal things for people perhaps that have dealt with a crisis or, you know, some serious issues in their lives. I've lived through a civil war on Bougainville Island in New Guinea and was caught up in a shooting one night and had to administer first aid to a wounded soldier. And it wasn't until years later at uni and I was studying psychology that I realised that I'd suffered from PTSD and quite severely. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and the symptoms that they or their loved one might suffer as a result of a crisis or an emergency?
Well, you know, it's different for every person, and I guess the early warning signs, the things to look for, are changes in behaviour, I guess appearing more stressed or more anxious about things that they wouldn't normally get more stressed or anxious about. Yeah, things that they sort of wouldn't normally get upset about that they get upset about. They're kind of the classic signs of things like that. It's also, you know, the classic signs of things like depression or anxiety in terms of, you know, withdrawal from social activity, the inability to sort of, I guess, maintain a level of calm, you know, like sort of becoming more angry about different things. Also, I'm going to take me back to my psychology days now. For me, it's sort of with anxiety and PTSD, that it manifests in so many different ways. You know, some people get sweaty palms, some people get little knots in their stomach, some people just lose it and freak out. It's just manifests itself in so many different ways. I guess the thing is to be aware of the people you're around and how they change as a result of these kinds of things. And just keep the main thing, keep talking about it. Don't just go, oh, yeah, that happened, it's done and dusted. It's like, well, this happened, that affects you in this way. Okay, this is what you feel. And actually have those conversations around that. No, you don't have to have the conversation every day, but for me, one of the things that, because I experience anxiety, one of the things that my husband does sometimes is he turns around and he says, you're having a moment, aren't you? You're actually getting really anxious about this, aren't you? And I'll go, oh, yeah. And as soon as he sort of does that for me, it's a recognition and it's a, okay, now I can do what I need to do to actually sort of get myself back in the right space,
yeah.
Whether that's meditation or whatever. Yeah. It's really about that monitoring each other's behaviour, understanding what the person's gone through, you know, talking about what the person's been through and how they've come out the other side of it and what they feel as a result of that, assisting them to get the help they need and encouraging that, I think, is really important, and normalising it. I think that's probably the word I've been looking for when I've been thinking that through my head at 1,000 miles an hour, is normalising it, because so many people experience anxiety, depression, PTSD as a result of things they've been through, both personally and others that they've had no control of, you know, such as natural disasters.
Yeah.
And there's others that have things like survivor guilt, you know. Yeah. All my 10 neighbours around me were wiped out by this cyclone, yet my house is still standing and we're fine.
Yeah.
It's still a lot for them to go through. And I think, too, sort of community isn't what it used to be, in that we're more sort of disparate and we're not sort of as connected as we used to be in our communities. Nothing brings a community closer together than a natural disaster, but it also splits apart. So there's a whole period of you come together, then as the disaster sort of dissipates, you split apart. But in actual fact, what you need to do is stay together a little bit longer and work through those issues.
Yeah. How did you deal with
that? That have occurred as a result.
How did I deal with it?
How did you deal?
How I dealt with it was I couldn't eat for about 2 or 3 days afterwards, and I felt really guilty because while this whole crisis was going on, I thought my children were asleep upstairs. Now, if I was thinking sanely at the time, with all the noise and so forth that was going on, nobody could have slept through that. And so they were upstairs shaking in their beds, terrified, because they didn't know what was going on downstairs. So they were fine afterwards, so they weren't a problem. But I was very anxious. I couldn't eat. I lost about 5 kilos in 3 days, and I just had to fly back to Australia because I couldn't cope. Not that I would say that I couldn't cope. It's just that I felt like I had to get away. And one of the hardest things I had to do was actually go back and take my sons back into that environment again. But I couldn't live in that same house, and we had to move. And then I went through a process of complete withdrawal. And I'm quite a social person, so I would take the children to school, you know, to drop them off and go pick them up, and I would just not leave the place at all. I wouldn't see anyone. I didn't want to go anywhere. I didn't want to talk to anyone. You know, I didn't realise what was going on until many, many years later. And there was no sort of support from the company either, which was a little bit disappointing when I think about it, that I think in these days with the crisis that was going on there, there would have been a lot more support now than there was at that time. So
that's something we focus on a lot with our clients nowadays, yeah. Is that looking after next of kin, looking after the actual survivors of any kind of crisis.
Yeah.
Actually, how to do that, because it's so important. And so many companies do just, let you sink or swim. And more and more are coming on board and actually realising they actually have that duty of care. But it's a case of they don't know what to do with it.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
And that's what you mentioned before about, withdrawing and isolating yourself. One of the tools that I used to use in relation to anxiety, which was caused from post-traumatic stress, I started to talk about, how I was feeling and stuff with friends. But then what I'd do is I'd get them involved in my recovery and I'd actually make them take me out and set me challenges. So it was really quite interesting. And that made a big difference for me. But that, it was one of those quirky things, and probably because I sort of had studied psychology and was seeing a psychologist at the time, that I sort of went, this is what kind of thing I can do,
yeah.
And these are the people I can get to help me with it.
Yes.
And again, that's leaning on your network, so leaning on your family, leaning on your friends. Your family doesn't have to be your next of kin, they can be your friends. So
yeah, that's true, yeah.
So how old should our kids be when we start teaching them about being prepared for emergencies? Like, I remember...
Stop, drop and roll as soon as you can understand it. So I'm talking about fire in the home and things like that. It's basically anything that relates to sort of safety around kids. They start to absorb that really, really early. And the thing is, you can actually make a game of it.
Yep. Yeah, and I guess that's true, because I went to school in Canada when I was young, and we did earthquake practice when I was in kindy, where the teacher would make a certain noise, which apparently sounded like an earthquake, and we all had to hide under a table. And it was a huge game, because I was 5 years old and I didn't really understand what an earthquake was, because they hadn't had one where we lived since we lived there. But it was... I often think, what age do we teach our kids that? And what are some things, I guess, if you've got some advice for families, how can they prepare their homes for an emergency, particularly, if you do live in a fire, bushfire area, or if you're in North America or in the Europe where you are at risk of a snowstorm and trapped in your house for days and can't get out? What are some of the things you should have on hand?
Food, non-perishable items, but in particular, look, it's sort of what I said earlier about going to those websites and you get them, they're all over the world. The, FISA has the tools on their websites in the US. You'll have a bunch of different emergency service organisations all over the world that will have them, but they have toolkits for bushfire survival plan, preparing yourself and your family and things like that. And they're just little booklets that you can actually fill in yourself. You can actually get them from any fire station as well. They've got little one pages you can do. And you work through it as a family and you answer a bunch of questions. This is what we would do. This is where we'd go. It's really basic stuff, like in terms of this is where we live. These are the exits. This is our little go pack that we have. We have a box with, these different things in it. It might be your will, it might be a photo album, might be passports, licenses, all that kind of stuff. Might be 10 litres of water. It depends upon who you are, where you are. But there's so many different little kits available to individuals and families that they can use. It goes down to what you should wear. If you're in a bushfire zone and there's fires in the area and you haven't been asked to evacuate yet, what should you be wearing in case you do need to evacuate? Where would you go? What's your escape route? What I was talking about the stop, drop and roll, crawl outside of your house with your kids, lead the way, make a game of it. There's so many tools out there that are available on nearly all of the emergency services websites throughout the world that are around preparation for yourself and your family. Bushfire survival plans, flood survival plans, cyclone survival plans, all of that. They're so accessible and so available, and they're such good, simple tools.
Yeah.
They're available for business as well, for small businesses as well. For me, it's about if you know that you experience things like flooding, snowstorms, things like that, then the basics of it is you need to have a certain amount of battery power available to you, a certain amount of gas power available, gas fuel available to you. You need to have water. You need to have non-perishable food items, and you need to have a plan.
It just made me chuckle when you said cyclone plan. The first time a cyclone came my way.
Esky, beers and a deck chair.
No, you're going to laugh at this.
I'm from Queensland.
Yep, I was living in Mackay in North Queensland, and a cyclone was bearing down on the coast, and I thought, right, I'm going to get organised. I had my first son. He was only a baby at the time. And off I went to the shops. I can't believe I'm telling you this. I bought a box of candles and I got them and batteries and all of that. But the candles, I thought, yeah, well, that'd be, you know, we can light the candles. And then I thought, well, that's not going to be much chop if the roof blows off. But, yeah, the things that you do. Well, I was away a few weeks ago.
Just be without power for weeks.
I was away a few weeks ago at our family holiday house, and this absolute ripper of a storm came through and the power went out. And, you know, we've had that house for 25 years in our family and we have never had a blackout. So we had no candles, we had no torches, we had nothing. So fortunately, once the storm passed and I thought, oh, the power will be back on soon, until I went outside and realised that the power line over the road was dangling and not going to be back on any time soon. And I had friends coming over that night. So I had to go to the shop and spend $60 on a torch, batteries and candles. And I thought, this power better be out for a while to make this worth it, which it was. It was out for about 12 hours. So I also bought food and wine. So we had a couple of lovely bottles of wine with a lot of food, cheese and biggies, dip.
Romantic.
Yeah, romantic with my school friend who I hadn't seen in 30 years.
Can I tell you, when I lived in the Philippines, we used to have brownouts all the time. And it was generally a sign that one of us was going to go down to the Sari Sari store and buy beer and sit on the back veranda. It just became one of those activities. But we did always have candles and torches as well. Yeah, the cyclone thing's amusing. I grew up in Queensland and I have family that live in North Queensland. And, yes, many years ago, not so much nowadays, but, yeah, it used to be, you know, sit on the veranda watching the beach and the wind, and they were older than me. They were allowed to drink. You know, they'd have a beer in their hand and we'd just be sitting there going, wow. So, yes, not such a good plan. But,
I don't know. It works for me.
But
I didn't remember much.
Certainly human nature.
After a bottle of wine, I was pretty happy that there was a blackout. It didn't bother me that I wasn't, you know, that I couldn't cook anything or turn the TV on or that I had to stumble up the stairs to get to bed and stub my toe.
Coming out now, Mel.
It was a good night.
Look, they often are. It brings people together, the old blackout.
Yeah, yep. And it was good because I was down there for my school reunion, and my friend who was staying was, seriously, it was a girl I had not seen in 30 years. And we just talked and talked and talked and talked. Yeah, it was good fun. But, hey, you mentioned that you worked in the Philippines. What was that like in terms of emergency planning compared to in Australia?
What was it like is one question. Extreme highs and extreme lows all in the one day. In likes of emergency planning, look, it was very different in that it was very community-led response. So in Australia, we've got great emergency services and civil services to back us up and to help us out. And there's an element of community-led response in the first period before the emergency services make it into town and so on. Whereas in developing countries, such as the Philippines, it's very much, whilst they have a level of emergency and civil service in terms of military and what have you, it's very much community-led response and recovery. So that, by that I'm saying is the people go out into the streets and help each other. And, you know, the people go out and clear roads and pull out dead bodies and clean up and all of that stuff and support each other. And the government assistance arrives when it gets there. So depending upon where you are, You're in a more remote region, it takes longer. It can take days and days and days before anyone sort of gets to them if they're in remote areas. So it's very much about working with each other to identify what's lost, who's lost, how to fix it, how to recover it.
Interesting.
It's kind of hard to sort of put into words, but it's very much you can have some kind of flood or landslip here and it's cleaned up almost straight away. You can have a massive landslip somewhere like the Philippines and it's just a river of mud for 12 months.
Weeks. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time today. Before we go, can you just give us your top tip for people to get an emergency plan in place for their home?
Oh, God. Okay, no, seriously, my top tips are, and I've said it about three times, go to your emergency services website.
Yeah.
Best ones, my favourites, ses.newsouthwales.gov.au for flood safe, cyclone, tsunami. In terms of bushfire, www.rfs.newsouthwales.gov.au. Go to the community sections on both those websites, community safety sections, and they'll have a heap of tools that you can use.
Great.
Go down to your local fire station. Make sure you've got a go pack. So if you live in a bushfire area in particular or a flood area that you know is going to be inundated, have a box. And in your box, have all your important documents, have some cash, have some any medications that you need, have some food, have spare sets of clothes and some necessities and just make sure that it's ready to go and that it's the thing you grab on the way out. And teach your kids what to do in the event of fire or flood, because I think that's really, really important.
Mm. Just in terms of cash, when my mother died and we were clearing out paperwork, my brother and I, Dad had this big safe and each of us had our own file with our important documents, so birth certificates, passports, you know, marriage certificates, whatever. And in Mum's file was an envelope that said, for emergency use only. And so we opened it up thinking, I wonder what this is, and it had $1,500 cash in it. And the date on the envelope was 1995, and she only died in 2010. But the money, we sort of surmised that she'd put that $1,500 in there because that would have gone towards an airfare if my brother and I, who were both living in Canada at the time, needed to get out of there quickly or if she needed to come over because one of us was in trouble. And I just thought, what a thing to think about, you know, but how organised was that to have that? And they didn't have a lot of money then, so that would have been a huge amount of money. And Dad clearly didn't know about it because he was pretty shocked when he opened the envelope.
That's where that money went.
But what a great, you know, what a great idea. Yeah.
Do you know, it's something that because we live in such a cashless sort of society nowadays, it's something we don't tend to do. But certainly I know that there's a lot of people from an older generation that have stashes of cash in different places around around the shop.
Yeah.
And they do it because of that kind of reason. So, you know, in case of an emergency, it's the old ICE. Yep. Oh, that's another thing you should do. Put on your phone in case of emergency contacts because particularly if you've got locks on your phone, particularly because I know with iPhones, I need to lock mine, otherwise my son would probably wipe it. And, it's about finding ways to make sure that people can actually get into your phone to get your next of kin contact details in the event of emergency as well.
I think Apple has
But the other thing is I think that
Apple has a little nifty gizmo that you can use. Yeah. We'll put instructions for it on the show notes for this episode.
Oh, cool. That'd be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is to really, it's along the lines of what we were talking about earlier. You know, if you have been through any kind of disaster or personal trauma or personal tragedy or anyone in your family has, keep the dialogue open and keep an eye on them.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, that was really interesting. Thank you so much. Before we go, Before we go, where can our listeners find you and where is the best place for them to connect with you?
All right. The best place to connect with me is via LinkedIn. I'm also at our business name is Tiger Tail Australia, so I'm at www.tigertail.com. www.samanthaford.au, and all our contact details are on our website. Love talking to people about these kinds of things. We regularly speak at conferences and regularly just talk ad hoc to people about it all the time because we're very passionate about it. Having been in emergency responders, we get quite into it and have some really bad sense of humour around certain things, but it's what keeps us sane. Yeah, so please feel free to connect. And, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Activity Pod. Continue the conversation over at theactivitypod.com, where you'll find the show notes and all the other fantastic episodes together with links to our Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivitypod, or tweet us at theactivitypod, where you'll find Annette and Mel every day. Theactivitypod.com is also a place where you can connect with Annette and Mel directly. Thanks for joining us today as we find better ways to help you focus, become more productive, and get stuff done so that you can gain greater freedom to choose what you want from life. We'd love you to join us in our next episode where we look forward to helping you with accountability so that you can get stuff done.